Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of Yoga International.
And I'm Kyle, the AV guy.
And today we're joined by Jivana Heyman, the founder of Accessible Yoga. We're here in Santa Barbara in his beautiful studio, Santa Barbara Yoga Studio. And hi, Jivana, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the first thing that we always ask all of our guests on Yoga Talk is about their yoga story. What is your yoga story? How did you start practicing?
Well, it's a long story. But I can say that I actually started when I was a kid. My grandmother practiced yoga, and so sometimes I would just sit and watch her when she was practicing every morning. She was really ahead of her time. What's really interesting, actually, is that, you know, I just did that with her when I was really young, and she had studied with Swami Satchidananda, the founder of Integral Yoga. And then after college, you know, I stopped for a while, and then after college, I just like randomly fell into this yoga class, and it was also an integral yoga class, which is, wow. And I remember seeing Swami Satchidananda's picture, and I was like, oh my God, my grandmother had that picture, you know, so it was kind of like this feeling of, oh my gosh, here I am back with the same teacher.
Just for our listeners who might not be familiar with integral yoga, can you give us a brief synopsis of what is integral yoga?
Yeah, so integral yoga is a school of yoga that was founded by Swami Satchidananda. He came to America from India in around 1966. In fact, last year was the 50th anniversary of integral yoga.
You have an article in America. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll link to it.
And it's mostly an American organization. It was kind of big in the 60s and 70s mostly. He was sometimes known as the Woodstock guru.
That's right, yeah.
he was at Woodstock, and he opened with a chant. He opened Woodstock, and he's well known for telling the people at Woodstock, you know, show the world what this generation can do, and, you know, be peaceful here. And they were, you know, so they kind of did. He's been an incredible influence and teacher for me. And integral yoga is basically, you know, a very classic hatha yoga tradition with a kind of focus on healing. And so one of the people that came out of that is Dean Ornish, who is a famous cardiologist.
Right.
Yeah. And I got to work for Dean Ornish for a while, teaching yoga for his heart disease program. So that was a huge influence for me to see the way he was using integral yoga and yoga in general for healing.
So tell us a little bit about your organization, Accessible Yoga.
Well, actually, like I said, I was working for Dean Ornish and teaching yoga for people with disabilities because it started because I was really involved with AIDS activism in the early 90s. And many of my friends had HIV and AIDS. In fact, my best friend died of AIDS in 1995. That's exactly the same year I graduated from teacher training. So I immediately wanted to share yoga with that community. So I started teaching yoga for people with HIV AIDS in San Francisco. And then just kind of kept expanding to include people with different disabilities. And I was just really motivated by my students. They, in general, like took to the teachings more than I found my able-bodied students doing it. Like I was so amazed and kind of blown away by many of my students with disabilities who were transforming themselves using yoga. You know, I saw that illness and disability can be like a huge motivator.
We recently filmed the Accessible Yoga Conference here in Santa Barbara with you last year, and that happens it's twice a year, right? The Accessible
Yoga. Well,
now it is. And we have that available online if you're interested in accessible yoga and participating. Highly, highly recommended. Of course, I'm a little biased here, Yoga International, but I think we got to attend, and it was just an amazing experience, and it was wonderful to be able to study with all of these different teachers and to really learn about like all of the different ways that we in the yoga community as a whole often unintentionally bar people from practicing because of the way practice is perceived, because of the way classes are marketed, the way we talk about yoga in the media, and how we can really make a difference in opening up our classes and our community to everyone.
Yeah. I mean, the conference came out of my experience where I was I had moved to Santa Barbara from San Francisco, and I didn't really have community here. And I realized that is how most yoga teachers feel, that most of them are out on their own. And especially people who are serving populations that don't have access, they're like basically you know, doing that without support of any other organization. So Accessible Yoga really became kind of a support and advocacy organization for people who are bringing yoga to people who don't normally have access, people who wouldn't just go to a yoga class. You know, that's the idea. Yeah.
And our listeners could go to, is it accessibleyoga.com?
.org.
Is that, .org, yes, of course, accessibleyoga.org to learn more about accessible yoga. But I know one thing that we really wanted to talk about today, Jivano, was yoga philosophy in particular and making yoga philosophy accessible. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that's so important and also the ways in which yoga philosophy might be or feel or seem inaccessible to a lot of people?
I mean, basically, yoga philosophy to me is the foundational teachings that are what the yoga practices are built on. And, you know, so often we go to yoga and we just practice the physical part of yoga, the hatha yoga, which is beautiful, but it's just one small piece of this incredible array of practices and teachings that make up what yoga is. That's the main way that I think yoga is not a yoga. Philosophy is not accessible. It's just that we have a misunderstanding and we think that yoga is just about the physical. So I would just start with that and say that that's the first challenge, is to realize there's so much more, and that actually the physical practices work because they're based on a set of teachings that are incredibly powerful and transformative, you know. And so the physical practice is great, but it works because it actually works with the mind. So yoga is really about the mind. That's the main thing I like to say. Yoga is learning how to calm and quiet your mind and deal with the challenges and pain and suffering in your life so that you can be peaceful.
And it seems like one of the things that makes yoga so unique to me as opposed to anything else that I've ever done, any form of exercise, any activity in a lot of ways, is that when I'm practicing yoga, and I've heard a lot of people say this, I'm not really doing it for the sake of the yoga practice, most of the time anyway, I hope, but rather to, because it makes my life better, because it makes me more able to navigate my life in the world and my relationships with people and my relationships with my mind and with myself more skillfully, more easefully. Whereas, you know, there's so many other things I can do. I can practice, like I can practice, I don't know, rollerblading, and, you know, maybe I get a little calm, a little relaxed rollerblading, but mostly I want a rollerblade so I can be good at rollerblading. And with yoga, it's not like about being good at yoga or bad at yoga. It's just about the ways the practice can serve us and others.
Exactly. You know, the yoga teachings are found in two places, generally, that we look nowadays. One is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and the other is the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Yoga Sutras, the practice is defined as an effort towards steadiness of mind. And I'm saying that because it relates to your example of rollerblading, which is that, you know, oftentimes we, in our lives, we find this kind of peaceful, blissful state naturally in things that we love to do. Like sometimes when you're rollerblading, probably you get into that flow.
You
right?
clearly haven't seen me rollerblade.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Example. I know exactly what you mean.
No, but I mean, it happens for all of us. It's actually our natural state. So our natural state is actually the quiet mind in a flow. And flow is a beautiful word because that's actually a word that's used in these teachings as well. When the mind is completely immersed in something and there's a steady flow from the mind to that object or that activity, then there's a stillness and kind of a timelessness that happens. So you could be rollerblading or even, you know, cooking. Some people love cooking or rock climbing or, you know, whatever it is that you love to do, like that thing you love. Probably what you love about it is it gets you into that flow, like dancing, making music, or listening to music. Yeah, those are great examples. Art is really good at that. But the thing is, with all of those activities, you may or may not get into that place. And what's great about yoga is that it is designed to give you that experience. That is what yoga is for. So the thing about yoga is, no matter what, if you practice, you're going to get to that place. It's like a sure thing. I mean, you might have to practice a long time, but you will get there. And with other things like rollerblading, you may or may not. So that's the beauty of yoga. It's like literally designed to calm the mind. That's what all of it is about. It's like quieting and calming the mind, and not necessarily in a way where it's becoming like dull or asleep, but just that it's focused.
Yeah.
In that flow, that just like completely focused place that's so beautiful, isn't it? Like, so great to be in that state of mind. Yeah.
I've noticed, and I say this as a novice and relative beginner to yoga, 1 or 2 years, but I know that sometimes when I'm practicing in certain spaces, if I'm not comfortable in the space, my focus is highly lacking, and I feel very scatterbrained and just paying attention to everything other than what's going on in my own body. And if I'm in a different environment where I'm much more comfortable, that I feel much better during the practice and I'm much more focused. But I know for me, there's just some places where I can't get into that level of focus or that state for whatever reason. What and why?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, when you're practicing yoga, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Feeling, yeah. I think the thing is to make friends with your mind and to try to find a way of working with it rather than against it. So, sometimes when you look at the yoga teachings, they seem a little bit about controlling the mind or quieting the mind, and it feels a little bit overwhelming or hard. And I think it's actually more like make friends with your mind, have a healthy relationship with your mind. To me, that's what yoga does. Is like, and so that, to me, like what you're saying, it just means that sometimes your mind is more disturbed than others, and we all have that. I mean, you know, I go there. There's times where something's going on in my life, and it just totally gets my mind racing, and I can't stop it. And it just, you know, even after I've been doing this a long time, and it still happens. So that, maybe that doesn't give you hope, but I mean,
it does. It's comforting to know. Because overall, you're a pretty, you know, calm, balanced, focused person. So to know that even you get distracted makes me feel better about my own distraction.
I think it's just the way the mind is. It's like, they say the story is always about the mind is like a drunken monkey. You know that one? You know?
Yeah.
But then they say, who's stung by a scorpion? So he's in pain too. Yeah. I actually think pain is a really good topic actually to talk about, because I think that suffering in particular and pain is one of the things that I really want to make more, the teachings about that are what I'd love to make more accessible in yoga, because I think there's such beautiful and profound teachings about how to respond to these challenges we have in our life. And in the sutras, there's this great section that the second chapter, a book, the first sutra, so it's the first teaching on yoga practice, and it's called Kriya Yoga. And there's three parts, which is basically tapas, svadhyaya, ishvara, pranidhana. And it's a three-part process. And basically Patanjali is saying, this is how you practice yoga in life. And like that is really exciting to me, because that's what I really want to know. You know, I mean, I want to know how to respond not only during my practice, but all the time. Because like if you practice an hour, well, most people, you probably practice all day, Kat, but most of the practice like an hour, you know, maybe a day if we're lucky. And then you have like 23 hours to not do yoga and to expect something to happen.
Well, it's like, I always remember Todd Wolfenberg, our CEO, he's a quiet fellow, but every now and then he gets the mic and he has really great things to say. And he wrote this article for Yoga Dork like a couple of years ago. And one thing he said was, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, I don't remember exactly what it was, but he said, you know, if you go to your yoga mat for an hour every day, it doesn't really matter if you're a jerk to everybody the other 23 hours.
I know.
That's really, really what practice
is
about.
That's what I love this teaching. So it's like, it's basically saying, here's how you practice yoga in your life. And he says, the first part is accepting pain or suffering as a way to learn about yourself. That's kind of, you know, this translated a lot of ways, tapas, but that's my translation.
I like that translation.
Yeah, it's like you say, okay, here's some challenge. So like something happens and it gets you and you realize, wait a minute, here's an opportunity to learn about my mind. It's almost like you have to be your own therapist. You kind of have to separate a little bit from your mind and kind of analyze it. And then the second part, svadhyaya, is like reflecting on, well, where did I get attached? What challenges, you know, do I have? Where does my mind get stuck and caught in the world and why? And then third part is basically means have faith or surrender, basically. Have faith that the wisdom, the divine wisdom inside of you will understand how to deal with the situation and you'll be taken care of. Because this is what's so beautiful about yoga, is that it's completely positive practice based on this idea that we are complete and whole already, that we're divine beings having a temporary human birth and that's the truth of who we are. That's our, and that part of us is never going to change, and it's never going to die, and will always be there. And I think that shift is like opposite of the way we normally think.
Absolutely. That's one of the most beautiful translations or explanations of Ishvara Pranidhana that I've heard too. I really like that.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. It's like, yeah. I usually read it and I think I can't relate, but if you make it into like normal, I don't know, normal language and thoughts, I think it's more accessible. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say.
And I think that's a thing that a lot of yoga teachers struggle with too, because we might want to incorporate more philosophy in our classes, but especially if we teach in, a non-traditional environment, like maybe a church basement or a community center or someplace that's not a yoga studio where it might be a little more expected, we wonder if our students will receive what we have to say or if we can say it in a way that will allow them to.
I think that most yoga teachers get just a little training in yoga philosophy, and so they have just kind of a little bit of an understanding, and they're a little afraid that they might say something wrong too, you know, that they might not understand completely, and it's Sanskrit and it's complicated. And so I would just, what I ask people to do is to study themselves more, not worry so much about bringing into class right away, but if they're interested in yoga philosophy, to find translations of the Yoga Sutras or the Bhagavad Gita that really they can relate to, because that's the other thing. You have to find a really good translation. You can find versions of both of those books that make absolutely no sense.
You know absolutely. What I mean?
And then you can find other ones that mean a lot. So I would just, if it doesn't make sense, just put it down and find another one and just explore different ways that contemporary teachers are looking at those teachings and just try to experience it yourself. Like, what does that mean in my life? You know, what is tapas? I mean, to me, that's a big teaching. Like, how do I respond to difficult situations and challenges in my life? How do I take care of myself? You know, how, and then look at how do these teachings work for you, and then you can share them with your students, I think.
Yeah, and then it comes from a place of your own experience too, and not just, it feels a little bit more authentic. And I know, at least for me, if I'm able to realize that I am sharing something from my own experience instead of just parroting something that I'd memorized or heard, then I feel more confident about it. I don't feel like, am I saying this right? Are they going to take this the wrong way? It's just because, it's your experience is your experience.
So the challenge, I think, is finding versions of the teachings that you can connect with.
How does the weight of that fall on the student? And what can you do as a teacher if you have a student who is not particularly receptive to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting too, because I grew up in the Midwest and I started teaching yoga in the Midwest when I was in college. And the area where I grew up is pretty religious. And that was always the challenge, is I was always very worried that I was going to say something that would offend someone in some way or make them think that I was saying something that went against their religion. And then when I moved to the Pacific Northwest, I had the complete opposite problem, basically, where everyone was much less religious, and I had to make sure what I was saying didn't sound too spiritual or religious in general. So there was always that balance, I think. And I think that that's where a lot of teachers maybe fall into a little bit of discomfort, is we want to make sure that we don't sound as though we're trying to convert anyone to any sort of yoga religion that they might be.
I think part of it is letting go of the student's experience a little bit, and just, if the student doesn't want to hear it, fine. And if they're not going to be interested in that part, fine. But I think what I find is that the student relates to the teacher's feeling. So like, in a way, the teacher transmits more than the teaching, but their relationship to the teaching in the way they talk about it. So if the teacher really is embodying that practice and really thinking about it and working on it in their lives, then I think the excitement and interest comes across to the student. But if it's like a lecture that feels really stale, then I think that could put people off. Just like with chanting, like I have the same feeling. Like sometimes teachers ask me, like, well, should I include chanting or not in my classes? And it depends on your relationship to chanting. Like, if you really love chanting, then your students probably will love it. Like, if you really care about it, they'll want to know, So I think that's the thing, is like, you're giving your students your energy.
I hear a lot of talk about that if you're going to teach, first and foremost, you need to be a student.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you're a good student, there's a certain level of enthusiasm that goes along with whatever you're practicing that.
Yeah. And there's a great, one of the slokas in the Bhagavad Gita says that the wise person doesn't disturb the mind of the unwise person, but teaches by example. I mean, I'm paraphrasing basically, but like shows them through their life. So I think that's what it is. It's like, you know, there's no point in just talking about teachings if you don't actually really work on them yourself. I mean,
well, it reminds me of that St. Francis of Assisi quote. I don't know if he actually said this, but it's always attributed to him to preach the gospel all the time, and if necessary, use words, meaning like to share the teachings of, in this case, Jesus by the way you live your life instead of preaching at people.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't always lecture about yoga philosophy in my classes. I would actually generally don't. But I think there's so many ways you can express the teachings in the way that you talk to people, the way you respond, the respect you show to them and yourself. You know, I think there's so many ways to show that you're working on yourself. Because I find it can feel forced to just stop or start a class with a lecture or end with a lecture. You know, it can just be too much.
Yeah.
And also I'm not attached to what the student does. I think it's really easy for teachers to become attached to the result and be really focused on how their teaching is received. And it's hard, but you really have to let it go.
Well, that's like the whole thing that the Bhagavad Gita talks about is that, you know, you're not entitled to the fruits of you can't control the fruits. I'm very much paraphrasing that, but
actions.
Exactly
right.
Yeah.
Because the reason is, I mean, that's the thing I would like to say about the teachings in general, too. Because when we say it like that, it sounds so, it sounds like ethics and rules and morals. And what's so beautiful to me about the yoga teachings is that they are empowering because they are about your own inner experience. So the yoga teachings are not like other religious teachings that tell people how to live their lives. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's for. They're all about giving people tools to work on their own mind and so they can connect with the spirit inside of them. That's completely different than just rules that you should live by. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? The intention is very, very different. So like the teaching that you shared about not being attached to the fruits of your actions, it's for your own good. It's not like bad.
It's not like you're going to get punished by anyone. Yeah. You're not going to go to, I always joke about doing things and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go straight to yoga hell for
exactly.
that one.
Yeah. It's like, well, actually we're all in yoga hell because in our minds, you know, if your mind is disturbed, then you're in your own hell. I mean, hell is basically inside of your own mind and heaven also, you know, those are experiences. It's the inner experience that yoga is talking about. It's like, how do you feel? How well can you calm your mind and connect with something inside of yourself? That's the question of yoga.
You know, when I was thinking about this topic today before we got to the studio, one thing that I kept thinking of was how I started teaching yoga when I was pretty young, when I was 19 years old. And I was very interested in yoga philosophy, but I was also, you know, like most 19-year-olds, very insecure. And I talked about yoga philosophy a lot. I used Sanskrit a lot. And looking back, I did that, in my case, because I was insecure and because I wanted my students to think that I was smart. And I wanted people to see, like, how much I knew.
Yeah.
And when I look at now, like, I rarely will use Sanskrit in class. I don't usually reference, like you said, you know, like it might be underlying what I'm doing, even just subconsciously, but I'm not, you know, standing up and saying, the Yoga Sutra says this, everyone, and now listen to me talk. Whereas I probably did that a little bit when I was in my 20s. And it's just interesting to see how when we incorporate yoga philosophy in our classes, it probably doesn't mean we should do that. You know, that it's a good question for us as teachers to ask ourselves, who is this for? I think one of our writers recently, she wrote an article on teaching yoga to teenagers. And she said she's always asking herself, is this for them or is this for me? And if I'm talking about this philosophical concept or using the Sanskrit word because I want people in the class to think that I'm smart, then that's probably not the best reason.
No, it's just another trap for yourself,
yeah.
You know, another attachment.
Absolutely.
You know, an attachment is just something, anytime you want something outside of yourself or you need something outside of yourself to be happy, then you're basically giving away your happiness, giving away your power to that thing. And that's the reason I say the teachings are empowering, because yoga teachings are about saying actually happiness comes from inside of you rather than from outside.
And the great thing is then that really just underlines so much about how they really are for everyone, and yoga is for everyone, because you don't need to have a pair of $200 yoga pants in order to connect with that. You just need yourself. That's it.
Right. I mean, if our true nature is peace, which is what the teachings say, everyone has that inside. You know, everyone is equal and really the same in that place. Then, yeah, how could yoga be for one person more than another? And I mean, that's the problem I see by focusing so much on the physical part of the practice, is that it gives people the idea that if you can't do the physical practice, then you can't do yoga. And it's so sad, because the yoga teachings are actually about the fact that you're not the body. I mean, that's the irony.
Yeah.
Can I use that word?
Yes.
The irony of yoga.
Jivana always uses the word irony correctly, and I'm always impressed, because when you're an editor, you learn that most people don't use the word irony correctly.
But it is a great and very sad irony of yoga that we think it's about the body, but it's not. It's about the fact that you're not the body and you're not the mind. The yogis saw the body-mind as one thing. We have that kind of a spectrum. Body, breath, and mind is already connected. And what we're trying to connect with yoga, the union of yoga, is actually union with your spirit or with your true self, whatever you want to call that. Universal consciousness, divine essence, whatever that is for you. But that's the union that we're seeking, is connecting with that part of ourselves, which is always there, no matter what. Yeah. No matter what's happening in your life, that part is there and it never changes. So no matter how, if you have a disability or a chronic illness or some trauma or anything in your life, it doesn't affect that place inside.
Thank you so much for sharing those wonderful teachings with us, and in a way that's like so accessible too. Like really, like as we talk about making yoga philosophy accessible, we got to hear some very, very accessible and relevant teachings that, I don't know, left me certainly feeling empowered today. Before we finish up, is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners? Or any, perhaps, I know you mentioned finding a translation of the Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutra that might resonate with you if you're interested in sharing a little bit more, or learning a little bit more about yoga philosophy. But are there any other resources that you'd recommend?
I think there's too many, you know. There's so much. I don't know. For me, the sutras that I love, I mean, that, you know, Swami Satchidananda is my teacher, and I've really related to his version of the sutras in the Gita, because he's very down to earth and practical, and he gives stories and examples. I love Nischala Joy Devi. She does a translation of the sutras called The Secret Power of Yoga.
Oh, yeah.
That's really beautiful. Also, I really like a book called How to Know God by Christopher Isherwood.
Yes.
That's the sutras.
Yeah.
That's a translation of the sutras from the Vedantic perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are really so many, but I always go back to Swami Satchidananda, because I feel like he just has a really straightforward approach, you know, to those teachings. You know, and I lead trainings. People can study with me.
Yay! And they can find those trainings at
accessibleyoga.org. You know, of course, I would just pitch the conferences again, that if anyone's interested, you know, they can join us online at our online conference or in real life at a upcoming conference.
Kyle, do you have anything to add? Any other questions?
Can you give us a brief definition of accessible, and perhaps a bullet point list of ways in which yoga philosophy is made inaccessible?
So you mean the word accessible,
right,
or what that means to me, or accessible yoga?
Yeah.
I mean, accessible yoga comes from my desire to share yoga with people who have disabilities or chronic illness or any challenges in their life, but it's actually a really broader concept that I strive to share yoga with everyone who's interested. I mean, you know, not everyone wants to practice, and that's fine. But anyone who's interested in yoga, even a little bit, they should be able to access these teachings easily. And that's the goal of accessible yoga, is just broadening the reach of yoga and doing it in a way that's inclusive and empowering and positive. You know what I mean? Using the good part of yoga. Not the exclusive negative part. Is there a negative part? Well, I guess what I mean by that is that I think I'm not trying to say that everyone should get the yoga pants and buy a lot, you know, spend a lot of money on yoga. What I'm saying is, I want people to be able to access the, you know, the core teachings in an easeful, relaxed way. And I don't know. I'm working on it. You know, that's my vision. I'm working on a new vision right now. I've had an amazing few years because like the conferences and my trainings have like done better than I had imagined, and I had just kind of, that was my vision, and now I see that I need a new vision. Like, I need to really think about what you asked me, which is, how can we, as a yoga community, share these teachings with people who really need them? Because I feel, actually, in my heart, what I feel is this sense of responsibility. Because I feel like I've been given this amazing gift, and that it's just selfish for me to just keep it to myself, you know, and not share it with everyone. Because it's been so transformative for me, and I just wish that for everyone. And then you want a list of...
Bullet points of how yoga
Bullet points, specifically.
Okay, how yoga philosophy
can be made inaccessible.
Inaccessible, okay. I think, one, we use the word philosophy. I think immediately that turns off half of the audience. They think, I don't want philosophy, you know. How's that going to help me? Two, I would say, people think, I don't have time to study this, right? I don't have time to put into that. I'm busy, I have stuff happening in my life. So we don't find ways to make the teachings clearly applicable in directly to modern day life issues that people have. So I think that's maybe the second way that's not accessible. Third, I think the yogis themselves don't grasp the teachings that much, or don't want to. I don't know why, but I feel like there's a kind of a lack of awareness about the teachings that we have at our disposal. For example, yoga meditation techniques, which we tried some today, are so beautiful and powerful, and yet I see a lot of yoga teachers looking for other kinds of meditation all the time. And not to put down Buddhism, for example, but Buddhism is a different tradition that comes out of yoga. And I see a lot of people do yoga asana and then they do Buddhist meditation. And that's interesting to me, because I wonder, why not just stick with the yoga teachings and the yoga meditation? So if that means, that was one bullet. yoga teachers themselves. I mean, I don't mean to be condescending or obnoxious, but I don't think a lot of yoga teachers really get the yoga philosophy themselves. I mean, I'm barely getting it.
In our 200-hour teacher trainings, too, I mean, 200 hours is really not that much time, and a lot of it is not in the classroom. And, you know, I think that we're so focused on learning how to teach a class where we don't hurt anyone and we say everything we mean to say and where it makes some sort of sense, that, like, we barely get to scratch the surface on the philosophy just because there's not the time.
It's almost like a whole separate thing. You know, it's like you do a 200-hour yoga training, even if it has some philosophy in it, you still have to go back. I mean, I had to go back over and over and over again. I still do. I mean, I go back to the same teachings, and every time I read them, I think, oh my God, I had no idea. I didn't understand that at all. You know, so it changes where you are in your life.
I think if I would add anything, I would maybe add that the way those of us who are interested in philosophy, and by those of us, I mean probably me, at least at some point, that the way we tend to talk about philosophy can be exclusive. It can be really academic. It can be really esoteric. It can be really either like almost too flowery or too, again, just like scholarly. And it's not necessarily in a way that a lot of people can relate to.
There's something I found that in having conversations with different people who are immersed in the philosophy at different levels, or maybe just a different level of interest. Kat, as you mentioned, describing it with overly flowery language, that I feel is kind of like trying to intentionally befuddle you.
And I mean, on the other hand, too, I guess that flowery or poetic is kind of an easy thing for me to pick on, because I feel like I don't resonate with those things that much unless I'm like putting on airs and trying to sound like someone that I'm not. So to me, if I hear that or see that, it's off-putting, and I feel like, oh, that person is trying to be someone they're not. But maybe that's just their personality. And maybe the fact that that very flowery language doesn't resonate with me, maybe there's someone else who's super into that, and that's going to be, they're like, wow, you're talking about all this spiritual stuff, and I'm just drawn to that, and I want to study that, and I want to practice that. So maybe some that is helping someone, but it could also be putting off other people.
I think part of it is that the teachings are so contradictory to the modern Western lifestyle that it's difficult for the mind to hold on to them. They're very subtle and they tend to kind of just go away. So, but I see the problem I see for most people is that they have to just like completely shift their perspective. You know, it's like you have one way of seeing the world, and the yoga teachings actually show you it's the opposite. Like one of my favorite quotes is from Hafiz. You know Hafiz, one of the bhakti poets from what's now Iraq in 1300s, and he said, "The world has its pants on backwards." That's so great. Which to me really defines the yoga teachings, actually, to say that we see the yoga teachings see the world the other way around. And so sometimes we go to these flowery, I don't know what, because it's like too overwhelming to actually be able to move our mind there. To like, that's the real asana, you know, like to be able to contort your brain around a completely different perspective on the entire world, basically. There's a famous mantra from the Vedas, asato ma sat gamaya. Though that means, lead me from unreal to real, from darkness to light. And it's just like, what does that mean? You know, what does unreal to real mean? And it's basically that idea of completely switching. It's saying that the material reality that we accept as real is actually, quote, unreal. And that there's the reality is the spiritual, the spirit. Actually, that's the real part. The human part is temporary. Am I going there? You go there. It's just like you have to go there.
Yeah, I think one thing that helped me make philosophy a little more accessible to me, I mean perhaps acceptable as well, accessible to me too, was reading. I was assisting a teacher training actually, and we were reading a particular translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and someone mentioned, they said, you know, this is really hard for me to accept. This is really hard for me to understand. It bothers me that it seems to be, you know, condoning violence in some sense. And I don't like it. And the teacher said, and I was like expecting the teacher to like just like have a rationale and say like, yes, you know, no, you're wrong. It's this. And instead she just said, yeah, it can be really hard. And You don't have to like it. You don't have to accept it. Like, you just have to read it because this is your 200-hour teacher training and you have to read it. And, you know, I think she mentioned, like, that your relationship with the text can change over time. But just, like, she wasn't trying to evangelize, I guess. She was just saying, this is what it is. You know, there are lots of interpretations. There are lots of understanding. Read it and see what you think. Yeah. And to me, that was really empowering because it gave me permission to maybe feel like, okay, there's parts of yoga philosophy, things that I'm learning, things that I'm hearing that I don't understand and that don't make sense to me or that I don't like. And I don't have to pretend to. I can just let it be what it is for now.
I mean, it is like thousands and thousands of years old. And so you think, sure, most of it applies. We haven't changed that much over the time, but some things may not. I guess what I was trying to get at before too is like not, it's a shift in perspective, but the idea is to actually find a way to integrate that into your life and to actually, to get some benefit from the teachings, to be peaceful and then happier. I mean, that's the goal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you can try and analyze and understand, but the fact is like, only if it makes you find more peace, then is it useful, you know, and working. I love talking about this.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. for sure. And I'm sure we could talk about it all day. So we'll have to have you back to talk about it more for sure. And listeners, if you have any questions for Jivana, you can send those to us and we'll make sure we pass them along. Or for us, anything you'd like us to talk about, perhaps in a future podcast when we're back here in beautiful Santa Barbara. Or, you know, if you want to come up to Honesdale, Pennsylvania, which is, I think, like -2 degrees right now.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah. No. You can send those to yogatalk@yogainternational.com. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening in. We'll see you again really soon. And
our podcast music is by Austin Joy.